Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
This is our World Cup special. This is where we are for the next 3 weeks. And it's a nice kind of Saturday Superstore kind of moment. And you're dressing down, not the suit and tie, which we've come to expect. Although you can't watch that on live streaming just yet because the cameras are sort of
cranking
into gear.
But you're wearing a Born Again Floozies t-shirt, so you're hardly dressing up yourself.
I always wear a Born Again Floozies t-shirt.
All right. They're a band down to your level.
The Born Again Floozies played on a show that we did from Indianapolis, and we were doing 5 states in 5 days. The Indianapolis show was absolutely it was fantastic. We booked them because they were a local band, and when we tested them out down the line, sounded quite good because we listened to them, and then they came and played on the show, and they were terrible. But it's a great t-shirt, so I really like it. So that's, and you've got a Clash t-shirt, which is slightly more conventional. So we're here until 12. We need your participation, of course, as ever. mayo@bbc.co.uk. And then the football kicks off again from midday. So we'll get to the new releases, which are, remind us, the things that we will try and get to.
We'll definitely do MacGruber, Killers, Hiero, Please Give. Certainly those four. We will try also do Our Family Wedding, Ajami, and Wild Grove. We might get to the new Alan Rene film if we are in time. The latest octogenarian offering.
Something to look forward to. Just before midday. So this from Phil. Dear Fathers Ted and Jack, in last week's show, you read an email from Sam White, who is now working in Hollywood, yeah, at the studios where Pirates 4 and Transformers 3 are being dragged into existence. I think the best, and basically Sam got in touch with us and said, you know, I walk past this office on a weekly basis, on a daily basis. Is there something you'd like me to open the door and shout? Mm-hmm. And your suggestion last week
was stop.
Just stop. That's what you were suggesting. He says, I think the best way for him to protest against these and still retain his job would be to protest in the manner of Father Ted and Father Dougal at the showing of The Passion of St. Tibulus in Father Ted. They are required to protest against the blasphemous new film on the orders of Bishop Brennan. And they held up signs with the words,
Down with this sort of thing.
And careful now.
Careful now, I'd forgotten that.
I'd love to see that outside a pirate showing, says Phil Suffield. Now that is that's good. So Sam, working in Hollywood, down with this sort of thing on one badge, and careful now on the other. Dear Flanders and Swan, says Peter, to the chap with his first job in Hollywood walking past the office of Pirates of the Caribbean, should he not stick his head round the door and say, would you like a hand with a script? I've got 5 minutes.
Very good.
Dear Violent Femme and Big Hands, I know you are the one. I too am one of those Hollywood hacks that have worked on several films that have been both lauded and panned by you and the Good Doctor. More recently, I was the music editor on Prince of Persia.
Oh, wow.
How about that?
Yeah.
And Walk the Line as well. And the upcoming Unbelievable True Story, in inverted commas, Secretariat.
Very good.
I think he's identifying himself, this guy. For the listener that walks by the production room for P4... as it's known, Pirates 4, or more likely Pirates of Penzance due to Rob Marshall's penchant for musicals, I believe that there is nothing that can be done short of a stick of dynamite to stop this juggernaut, the full weight of some of Hollywood's mightiest are behind it. For myself, I hope to be far away on a tropical island, or perhaps working on a small foreign kind of film when the call comes to participate on one of these films, because they're well known for their profligate and painful birth process.
I don't think it's called P4 because of Pirates 4. I think it's the Jack Warner thing about how many times you have to go for a pee during the film was how bad it was.
By the way, says our correspondent, they're mixing Sorcerer's Apprentice, another Jerry Fest, next door. And all I can say is I can't wait for Mark's soon-to-be-famous Flappy Hand review of it. And then, wonderfully, Sam White, our correspondent in Hollywood, gets back in touch. Dear Wilshire and Rodeo, I took your advice and on Monday morning did say stop as I walked past the production office of Pirates 4. There was no response.
Yeah.
Does this mean they were listening and decided to follow my advice immediately?
Very probably.
So that's it.
So down tools. They've down tools. That's
it. That.
Well done.
Sam, you're a very brave man.
Excellent.
Amy from Rochester. We'll get to the top 10 in just a moment. Dear Baker and Kelly, recently my husband and I took a weekend holiday to Toronto, and while there went to the Ontario Science Centre to see the Benjamin Snidlegrass experience. It was a great exhibit, and many of the actual props and costumes that were used in the first six films were there. While we were going through the first part, featuring school clothes and Hogwarts items used by Harry and co, an idea hit us both at the same time. Rather excitedly, but still trying to take in Hagrid's hut and screaming plants, we made our way to the dark arts area. There we spotted our quarry, dutifully marched up, tipped our hats, and in unison said a cheery, "Hello to Jason Isaacs' robes." That's something to shout, isn't it? Yes, they were the exact robes that he wore in Chamber of Secrets. It seemed only right, since we were so far away from the man himself, to send him greetings through his old costume.
Very good.
Perhaps you could give a nod to his robes, as well as to him, when you do your greetings next time. Amy from Rochester, New York. So we should say hello to Jason Isaacs.
And his robes.
And his wardrobe.
His wardrobe.
Assorted wardrobes as passed through
number
of films.
This is like the ambush bug of Harry Potter. Jason was apparently in Edinburgh last night or the night before, and I know this because somebody tweeted saying, "I'm about to interview Jason Isaacs in Edinburgh. What should I say to him?" And then a million tweetees from said, "Say hello." So he must actually be surrounded by the sound of people saying hello to him the whole time.
Do you think?
I think so, yeah.
Do you think it's getting on his nerves?
I'm starting to wonder.
And hello to David and to Stephen and assorted band members of Focus and Fairport Convention as we approach the festival season. Dear Pinky in the Brain, I saw this hand dryer on a recent trip via Billund Airport in Denmark and was impressed. And he sent us a little photograph. On it, it says Dan Dryer. See that?
Yeah.
Okay. Mark Clear.
Sorry.
Who knew that one of our top actors had an impressive entrepreneurial side? It coincidentally also sounds exactly like Dr. K's impression.
Does it? It goes, oh!
That's the one. Dear Braxton and Hicks, having sat through the first antenatal class and found out, much to our collective horror, that the whole palaver can last upwards of 24 hours, it occurred to me that we will require something to listen to, and thus was born the perfect plan. I plan to hoard the next few weeks' worth of your show in preparation for the big day, so that my wife, Natalie, has something to distract her from the pain, panting, and general flapping of hands, which is childbirth. Though I would think that actually flapping of hands is not particularly where the biological focus is.
No.
Or certainly hasn't been in the past.
No.
I am sure if you could provide a few words of encouragement or perhaps breathing instructions, it would make time fly. Okay, so this is Frank Gaillard, MBBS Honours, PG Dip Surge Antenatal.
What's more important is what's the name of his good lady partner?
Do you know?
Natalie.
There it is. So Natalie, who may well be listening to this then while giving birth. Hold on in there.
Breathe. That's the advice, isn't it? Breathe.
That's not very useful, though, is it?
I'm sorry. That's what the advice you is breathe.
You might be there a while.
I'd say it'd be a lot more useful if you didn't do it. That would be very unhelpful. But breathe, yes.
Hugh Collins in New York. Dear Twilight and Teenage Hysteria, thought the good doctor would welcome an update on the magnum opus that is The Last Airbender. Now, the trailers of the... I was in the movie... I saw the trailer for this the other day, and it's just a funny title.
Yeah, it is.
It just is. Straight away, you've got it. This is M. Night
Shyamalan...
hitting US screens, and it also has the haunting tagline, "The legend begins in 3D.
But if it's The Last Airbender, surely it's "The legend begins and ends in 3D. It's the last one, right?
Yeah, so we didn't know that there were any.
No, and now we do. And
somebody's down to the last
they're already they're gone.
The box office top 10, it's 11:19, 5 Live Saturday morning. At number 10 is 4321.
Which is the Noel Clarke film, where he came on the show and I said, you know, it's not for me. I think there are problems with it. Noel was quite clear that he'd made it attempting to bring along the sort of the lads mag crowd that he thought he'd attracted before, and I can see that he's trying to do that. It's interesting, somebody wrote in a couple of weeks ago saying, if you look at the top 10, how many movies actually do centre on female characters? Well, clearly 4321 does. The question about whether it's a female film about female characters for a female audience or for a male audience, I think, is the jury is out on. I don't think it's great, but I still think that Noel Clarke has got greatness in him, and I'm awaiting it.
She's out of my league at 9.
I was off, didn't see it.
Are you going to catch up?
Well, the thing is, there's 9 movies out this week.
And are you going to catch up?
I'll try.
Thank you.
Give me
by
a
next
break.
Robin Hood's at 8.
Well,
done that, really.
Yeah, done
Tooth
that.
Fairy at 7.
Which isn't as funny as the trailer. The trailer did make me laugh slightly. You said that that Dwayne was a lovely man.
Yeah,
That makes
impressive.
Me feel so slightly more warmly towards it. But, you know, it needs to be a lot funnier than it actually is.
Death at a Funeral at 6.
And again, haven't seen that, but that I am going to see this weekend, partly because it co-stars Peter Dinklage, who, for my money, is one of my favourite actors. I think he's really, really good, a really sort of intelligent, smart actor. He can do straight drama, can do comedy, and although I've read fairly poor four reviews of Death at a Funeral. Anything with Peter Dinklage in is worth seeing.
Brooklyn's Finest at 5.
Richard Gere, return to form. Blinky, blinky, oh how he blinks, but he is very, very good. It's one of those movies in which, you know, a lot of people do a lot of being racked with guilt and worry and anxiety, and it's an intertwining cop drama, and it's not a masterpiece by any means. Antoine Fuqua is the director, the guy who made Training Day, but I liked it, and it was great to see Richard Gere back doing something decent again.
Number 4 is Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, expertly mixed on the sound, I thought.
As I was watching it, I thought, boy, the sound mixing on
terrific.
That. It's, if I had to pick a mix, on the sound, I would pick the mix from Prince of Persia.
It's our favourite, isn't it?
It is.
And I think better than you actually... I know you said it was better than Pirates, but I think it's much better than that review would indicate.
No, it is better than Pirates. It's shorter than Pirates. It is funny. My only reservation was, it's the comment that was made by listener before about never trust a bald guy wearing mascara. It is also the fact that Sir Ben Kingsley is that. Just going, I have that performance already. I did it in the Thunderbirds movie. Would you like me to just reel this one out? Yes, I'll play the Hood. Sorry, what's he being called? Well, I will play him as the Hood anyway.
It should have been the perfect strap line, shouldn't it? Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, never trust a bald man in
mascara.
That's the clue. Street Dance 3D at 3.
First 3D film in which I've been unbothered by the 3D, although I have to say that since then I've seen Toy Story 3D, and, the goalposts are shifting. I remain completely unconvinced by 3D, but, you know, seepage, open-mindedness.
Slippage or seepage, would you say?
It's a bit of both, really, isn't it?
Oh, very interesting. Letters to Juliet at 2.
Which, you know, I didn't dislike. I kind of enjoyed it. I mean, I know there's a lot of things wrong with it and that it makes no sense and that they've got an Australian guy to play an English guy, which seems weird because it's like, what, there aren't enough foppy-haired English toffee, you know, types around to just pick one off the tree. But no, they had to go to the other side of the world to pick somebody who can't do an English accent. But, you know, I think Amanda Seyfried is charming. Vanessa Redgrave is great in this film as well. Vanessa Redgrave, literally, you could give Vanessa Redgrave the yellow pages and go... read that, and she'd do it in a way that made you go, oh gosh, she's really
and
good.
And Philip Seymour Hoffman.
But in a different... Philip Seymour Hoffman would read it in a kind of offhand, unbothered way. Vanessa would read it like it was Shakespeare.
Sex in the City 2 is at number 1. Just a couple of emails before we move on. Melissa in Bellingham, Washington. I appreciated the listener last week who defended women who go to see Sex and the City 2. Yes, it's utter poo, but we women get to see so few films that feature women as the central characters that we've been reduced to celebrating said poo.
Can I just say that I did say point well made and point taken. I understand that and you're completely wrong.
Relative to this discussion about women in film, I learnt recently about the Bechdel test. Am I saying that right? Bechdel.
You're looking at me like I would know. Okay. This is after asking me how I pronounce Ashton Kutcher earlier on.
A test that I'm afraid has utterly depressed me with its results. The test is very simple and asks only 3 basic questions about a film.
Yeah.
1. Does the film include 2 women with names? In other words, you've heard of. 2. Do these 2 women talk to each other?
Yeah.
3. Do they talk to each other about something besides men? We are now halfway through the year. How many films pass the test? To see just how unbalanced the film world is, we could also try applying the test the other way around to men. Does the film include 2 men with names? Do these men talk to each other? Do they talk to each other about something besides women?
Yeah.
There are films that do not pass the test.
It is interesting that we're having this discussion, particularly now because the World Cup is on, because one of the things that's meant to happen around the time of the World Cup is that you get counter-programming. The idea is... oh, the blokes are watching the football, therefore we'll put into the cinema movies that will appeal to women. I mean, this is not me being, gender stereotyping. This is the way the distributors work, which is why, for example, if you look at the top 10 now, there are 3, maybe 4 movies in there that you might say, oh, they are centred more towards a female audience. Whereas quite often you look at the top 10 and there are none whatsoever. It is true that it is a very, very big problem. And again, I would refer you to the thing I said before. You look back to the classic age of melodramas, what were then referred to as women's pictures, which are now seen as the great, you know, the great melodramatic films of all time.
Women's pictures.
No, that's what they used to call them.
There should be a section, you know, when you go to Blockbuster, that, you know, should be adventure, should be romance, women's pictures,
yeah, but of course, if you were looking in that section, you'd find now Voyager. You know, you'd find some of the greatest movies ever made. And of course, there was the weird thing that the demographic for cinema did not used to be completely twisted towards 16-year-old boys. It used to be twisted towards, you know, towards women and middle-aged women at that. I mean, that's the really strange thing, and that's when all so much great cinema was made. It is terrible that what we've now got left is what is referred to as chick flicks and action movies. And movies designed to make 14-year-old boys happy.
Thank you. So, it's 11:25, so high time something new was mentioned. For example...
On the subject of depressed... Right, MacGruber. Right, this is the latest Saturday Night Live spin-off. It may be a cultural thing with Saturday Night Live. I mean, the problem is television programmes don't generally produce great films. And Saturday Night Live has got more rotten films on its books than many television programmes. Then what happens is you get a skit from Saturday Night Live that often is a joke about something that actually doesn't travel outside of America anyway. And they think, oh, well, this skit is going all right. Let's turn it into a big movie. Anyway, so MacGruber is nominally a pastiche of MacGyver. Do you remember MacGyver?
Vaguely.
Fine. Okay. So vaguely. I don't remember it at all. But apparently, it was a 1980s sort of cheesy, action special agent-y type thing with a bloke. I'm gathering this from the movie. Okay, that the guy had a bad haircut and ran around being heroic. So they got
70s cop show. I think the 80s. Simpsons. 80s. 80s. Simpsons talk.
Yes,
about
apparently
it,
Marge is a big fan of it, or Marge's sister is a big fan. That's
Patty and Selma.
I'm going in not knowing anything about this except that it's a Saturday Night Live thing. So the deal is, there's this bloke, he's MacGruber, he's played by Will Fort. He's got a terrible feather cut haircut. They need him to do some stuff. They get him out of retirement. He doesn't want to come out of retirement. He comes out of retirement, and the baddie in this movie is Val Kilmer. Val Kilmer doing that thing that Val Kilmer now does, which is looking slightly embarrassed about the fact that this is where he's ended up. Anyway, here's a clip of MacGruber. And if you... Well, listen to this first. Here we go.
I have a new team now. Not only do I have Vicky St. Elmo, maybe you've heard of her, but I also have one of the greatest young military minds around. I mean, this guy's the real deal. And we're going to stop you.
Well, you certainly have a healthy imagination, MacGruber, but I don't know anything about a warhead.
You're lying.
Would you show Mr. MacGruber the door?
Let me tell you how this is going to go down. First, I'm going to kick you in the chin, breaking your jaw in four places. I'm going to take you and karate flip you over my back and then knee your nose into your brain, killing you instantly. I do want to get a throat rip in here. Think that's going to be you, small fry. Who's first? You did not just do that. That is a blowhunt! You owe me a blowhunt!
So he says he's going to do all the stuff. They throw him through a glass window, and then they throw his car cassette radio 8-track thing after him because it's a period gag. The period gag being that, you used to have to take the thing out of the car. And I'm watching this and I'm going, well, firstly, this is making me feel a terrible yearning for Will Ferrell to come and do this sort of stuff properly. Secondly, it's making me remember just how good Starsky and Hutch, the pastiche movie, was, because that was one of the very few occasions in which they took a period cop show and did a version of it that was genuinely quite funny. I mean, it ran out of steam, but it was genuinely funny. You remember that? You remember the Starsky and Hutch movie? Yeah. There were more gags in it than you expected. But more to the point, why is a movie that's so full of itself and so pleased with itself and so sort of, fond of its own self-referential humour, why is it so staggeringly unfunny? Is it, on the one hand, that it's just badly written, which it is? Is it, on the second hand, that the humour is played so broadly that, honestly, it's like opera? It's like they're shouting and telegraphing all the... I mean, you could hear that joke, I imagine, coming from the beginning of that thing. He said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and then, no, the joke is they're going to throw you through a window. So it's like every joke is arriving like a cross-channel ferry, honking and squawking and squonking and, turning round really slowly, and then the punchline arrives. There's an old maxim that repetition is a form of comedy, but you know what? Repetition is only a form of comedy up to a certain point. And the third thing is that there... And I
what
think
was
this,
the second thing?
That it's also clumsily done.
Right,
the
clumsily
third thing
done.
is
bad
that
script, clumsily done.
That
number three.
There's a level of crass coarseness about the humour which made me really depressed, because in order for crass coarseness to be funny, it actually has to have something below the crass coarseness. Vulgarity is fine if it's intelligent vulgarity, but just vulgarity itself is just vulgar. And I'm sitting there watching MacGruber thinking, and it's a long time since I've actually felt this, thinking, this is just vulgar. Not in any good way vulgar, it's just vulgar and stupid and boring and badly played and loud and shouty and making a joke of a television programme which I don't remember the first time round, aren't interested in the second time round, a spin-off of a television show which I have long thought has overstayed its welcome in the cinema and should get out of the cinema and back onto the small screen where it belongs by a bunch of people who, every time they yelled cut, threw their arms around each other and congratulated themselves on just how funny they'd all been. Well, everyone except Val Kilmer, who does the whole movie with the look of a man who really, really, really wishes he was doing something else. There's a Doors documentary coming out in a couple of weeks' time. Imagine that. The Doors documentary will be in the cinema at the same time as MacGruber. Val Kilmer, the man who once wowed in Oliver Stone's The Doors tagline, "No one here gets out awake," is now playing the villain in a third-rate Saturday Night Live spin-off. That's how bad it is.
Laura, B.A. Ons. This is back to SATC2, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
dear
Vivian
and Taylor. Well, Mark is making an interesting point. Uh-huh. She's on her own, but it's an interesting point. I thought it was great that he criticised the American cultural imperialism of the film. However, in that same episode, he used the phrase "over here" to refer to the UK. Brits using this term to refer to their own country when they're in their own country signifies internalised US cultural imperialism, and I was disappointed that Mark should do this.
A descendant from a Manx family who refer to people who come from here to there as comeovers, over here is a perfectly acceptable term when you're talking about being in England.
Right, OK. I'll have to take your word for that.
Thank you.
Dear Burke and the Master, this is Marcus Carter on the sofa in Sweden. As it's Saturday, I find myself in the lovely position of being able to listen and watch live whilst nursing a somewhat thick head caused by last night's travesty. Instead of my usual drive to work with a podcast on a Monday, I can now lie in my dressing gown and enjoy the full multimedial live experience. I've always doubted the true flappy-handedness of Dr. K, but good heavens, during the top 10, I saw more big hand action than I've ever seen in my life. I was actually convinced that I could feel the shift in the air in the room until I realised I had the door to the balcony open. However, this only added to the experience, so I suggest all listeners open a window or door to get the fully immersed experience while watching Dr. K better in 3D.
I tell you, the one...
You are an airbender.
I am. The one...
I suppose hands move so many ways. That bendy hair again.
The thing that... when I was at the BAFTA Television Awards, looking befuddled in the audience, wondering who...
They kept cutting to me.
I know. I did actually present an award, but I was so boring that they cut it out. And afterwards, on the way out, Armando Iannucci came up to me and said, "I'd just like to apologise for having saddled you with the flappy hands thing." He said, literally, we stuck the writer in the room with 30 seconds of a videotape, and that's what he came up with.
I'm quite grateful to Armando.
Are you? Thanks, Armando, for that. Anyway.
And a number of people have mentioned this, so I'll just do this email from Will, who says, "Dear B and P, future casting, is it me? Or is the actor who looks like no one in particular, but actually looks like everyone he plays, and I'm talking Michael Clough Blair Frost
Sheen,
he's the perfect person to play the very British villain Tony BP Haywood."
Yeah, there he is.
He's the guy who's taking all the flak in the States. He's the man who's been wheeled in front of the cameras and not doing a very good job about it because the Americans don't like him very much. But every time Tony Haywood comes on, everyone goes, "It's
Martin Sheen."
But Michael, that is his going to be
he is.
The next role.
Yes.
And thank you to everybody for pointing
Slick
that out.
Slick, the movie.
Okay, so we'll get to some more correspondence, but let's do the movies.
Okay, so Hierro is a new Spanish chiller. This is the poster for it. And at the top of the poster, it says...
holding out for a Hierro.
It says holding out for a Hierro. It says, from the producers of Pan's Labyrinth and The Orphanage, and it certainly owes a debt to the latter of those. The story is, what you have is a single mother taking her child on holiday on a ferry. The mother falls asleep, child disappears. They don't know whether the child has fallen over the side of the ferry, whether the child's been taken. She then becomes obsessed about finding the child, goes back to the island, and it's all about, in the way that great horror movies or chillers are, it's about melancholia, it's about loss, it's about obsession, it's about grief. It's not about gore and shocks and all that sort of stuff, and that is what all good horror really should be. Here's the interesting thing. There are elements in it of films that I really like. It's a 12 certificate film, incidentally. There are elements of The Vanishing. It reminded me somewhat of that short film Regard la Mer, which I very like. Most importantly, it reminded me of Dark Water, which I think is one of the great modern horror films, which looks back to films like Don't Look Now. It's just a really genuinely proper horror film about maternal anxiety and about children and about worries and nightmares and that sort of thing. Now, it's not as good as Dark Water by quite some distance. I think very few things are as good as Dark Water, because I really think that is one of the great horror movies of the last 20 years. But it does have, if you like The Orphanage, this isn't on a par with it, but it has that same sense of the uncanny. It's interesting that there's an awful lot of horror coming out of Spain in that area at the moment, in which they are doing genuinely uncanny tales, to tales that remind you of the kind of the ghostly traditions of the horror genre, which is so far removed from just the, you know, sleazy grindhouse stuff which is coming out of America, and some of it coming out of England as well. So it's not a masterpiece, but it's good. My only problem with it was there was a galumphing score, that an awful lot of the visuals were very sort of atmospheric and very ghostly and very chilling, but the score went bam 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 bam. Now, you could argue,
clappy hand alert,
yeah, you could argue that it's a Herman-esque score, because Hitchcock, it's funny, you know, if you watch Hitchcock's films, they're, you know, Bernard Herrmann. Oh, Bernard Herrmann.
How would I know if it's a Herrmann-esque?
Well, if it goes bum 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 bum, you know, there's an, basically Herrmann, he didn't underwrite. He wrote.
Wrote for umpar bands, did he?
It is, yes.
Is that how I spot a Herrmann-esque film?
Bernard Herrmann and the Bavarian umpar orchestra play Hitchcock's greatest hit. No, but you know, there's a certain
that's
sort
a release.
Of, there's a certain thing when you pastiche them, and actually it is pastiche, you kind of end up with that. And I couldn't decide whether what it was doing was a Herman-esque pastiche, or whether it was simply that they'd said to the, you know, to the composer, just go easy on it a little bit, but he'd gone off and come back with a 30-piece Brazilian samba orchestra. But there is a lot of bum ba 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 going on whilst the visuals are ghostly, but I did like it. Moving on from that,
can I just say, yes. Jonathan Holland in Madrid says, you just said Hierro, and you keep on talking about Hierro.
But
in Spain, it's Hierro. There's no H.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Thank you for correcting me. I mean, I had no way of knowing.
It's
so
quite
thank
straightforward.
You.
I think you just dropped the H.
Yeah, very good. And I stand corrected.
Jonathan, thank you.
On to the, again, because it's the World Cup. There is this theory that the World Cup being out, so it means you're going to get movies that are theoretically directed at female audiences, rather poorly served in this particular case by Killers, which stars. Now, we had a little discussion about this before we came on. Killers, do you pronounce his name? It's Catherine Hagel, Heigl, Hugel, Hagel.
It's got to be Heigl. If it's EI, it's got to be Heigl.
Okay, Catherine Heigl. I would say Hegel.
Why would you say
I'm going to say Hugel. I'm going to go for Hugel just to be Scandinavian. And Ashton Kutcher. And you said to me before we came on, how does Ashton Kutcher pronounce his name?
I was just saying, because a lot of people do say Kushta, clearly inappropriately, and it's Kutcher.
Yeah, well, it's K-U-T-C-H-E-R. Yes. So Kushta, so anyway, Ashton Kutcher. So the story is, Ashton Kutcher is a special... stick with me on this, is a special secret super agent assassin for the CIA, right? He's on holiday. Well, he's not on holiday. He's doing some secret assassination super stuff. Catherine Hagel, Hugel Hagel, is on holiday with her parents, the father played by Tom Selleck. She falls for him. He decides to stop being a secret super, you know, killer agent, and in fact to fall in love with and marry Catherine Hagel, Hugel Hagel. And he is then taken aside by Tom Selleck, who we suspect has been watching Meet the Fockers and has seen the Robert De Niro role and said, I'll have one of them. Here's a clip.
I know you're worried about Jen.
Why would I worry? I am confident that you'll never hurt her.
It's a nice shot.
Thank you. I was an Eagle Scout.
They really let you shoot stuff in the Boy Scouts?
So do the Marines.
Ah, Semper Fi.
That was yours.
I'm sorry, I thought you were...
Be prepared, Spencer. You would have learned that in the Boy Scouts.
I was in 4-H.
Robert Luketic, this is going to be a pronunciation nightmare, is the guy who directed Legally Blonde. He directed this. I really like Legally Blonde. He then went on to direct The Ugly Truth. He also directed Monster in Law, which wasn't very funny, and apparently he was involved in that Winner Date with Tad Hamilton, which would explain why it was on the television the other day. This has none of the spark of his finest work whatsoever. It is literally like watching a bunch of movies you already know without the good bits in them. It's like watching True Lies without Arnold Schwarzenegger, or watching Mr. and Mrs. Jones without Brangelina, or watching The Spy Next Door without Jackie Chan, or watching Meet the Fockers but without Robert De Niro but with Tom Selleck. I mean, it is just so completely devoid of laughs. And the sad thing is, it's being put out there as, you know, hey, you know, you don't want to do football, you do this, right? You know, you enjoy the, yeah, because I'm sitting there thinking, like, fine, I don't get the football at all. I've got nothing against Ashton Kutcher, incidentally. I mean, people say that apparently, you know, he's very successful and people like him, you know, he's very, but on the question of how do you pronounce his name, Kushta or Kutcher, he's Ashton Kutcher, and the film is complete chit.
Dear Maurice and Hen, well, that's very good. Thank you for that, and thank you for making it perfectly clear. Did you have to go on a course, by the way, for that? I think you probably did. If not, you will be going on one.
Thank you.
We did obvious taglines, which have been running for a while. Just a couple came in yesterday. Just think, I mentioned Gerald in Belfast. Favourite tagline. Actually, this, I think this is, might even be a genuine one for the Peter Weir film Fearless. Some people fear nothing. Which you would
very
think,
good.
That's,
very
that's
good.
True. And M. Alex Smith, PhD, Assistant Professor, Biodiversity Institute of Ontario and Integrative Biology from the University of Guelph. In Ontario, Canada. It's the longest address ever, but I just thought it was worth establishing his credentials. The wind that shakes the barley.
Go on.
Well, there'll be wind and the barley is moving. But, you know, it's if it's a statement like that, that's the tagline it's got to have.
Yeah.
There'll be wind shaking barley.
There is a film called The Tall Dark Man with One Black Shoe, isn't there?
He's a... That'll be just the one shoe, then. The Tall Blonde Man with One Black Shoe...
One Black Shoe.
...was, of course, originally Le Grand Blonde avec une chaussure noire. Now, that has gravitas.
It does, doesn't it?
Tall bloke with one black shoe.
Doesn't sound good.
It just sounds like... So, you know, the Englishman who went up a mountain and came down in Welsh...
No, the...
That would sound... In French, that would sound... The Hugh Grant...
What
in
was.
French,
that's a much better title. The Englishman went up a mountain and came down Welsh.
That would work, wouldn't it? And French, if someone could translate that, that would be terrific. Okay, so we have 12 minutes.
Okay,
it's our World Cup special. We're doing movies on a Saturday morning for the next 3 weeks. What do we have next?
Well, actually, the most interesting bit of counter programming is Please Give, which is the new movie by Nicole Holofcener, who has made a few films. About 10 years ago, she made a film called Walking and Talking. Then she did Lovely and Amazing, Friends with Money. Her great muse is Catherine Keener, who I love. I think Catherine Keener is a fantastic actress, really, really terrific. Something very, very sort of intense about her screen presence, and yet she appears to be doing so little. The story is that Catherine Keener is an antiques dealer who lives in an apartment with her soon-to-be philandering husband, Oliver Platt. They live next door to an old woman who is, you know, at the end of her life, and there is a sense that they are waiting to take over her apartment. Catherine Keener is fairly wealthy stock and is feeling guilty about the fact that she has money, is feeling guilty about the fact that she's effectively waiting like a vulture to take over this woman's apartment, feeling guilty about the fact that she has material possessions. When she walks down the street, she can't but help give her money away, which is immensely annoys her daughter and means that she doesn't realise that her husband is becoming involved with the daughters of the woman who lives next door. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. On the one hand, when I describe it like that, even listening to myself describe it, I think, oh gosh, that sounds terribly boring and I wouldn't want to go and see it at all. However, Nicole Holofcener has been described as making the kind of movies that Woody Allen made when he made those great Woody Allen movies that he sort of stopped making now. I think it's a slightly unfair comparison. I think she's perhaps closer to... I mean, there's even something sort of Hal Hartley-ish about it. I mean, you know, Nora Ephron is one end of this scale and Hartley is the other end of it. And she's sort of somewhere in the middle. She writes very talky, slightly neurotic, you know, intellectual characters, but not of the kind that I find so annoying when they turn up in Noah Baumbach movies, because they just do nothing but look at their navels and complain and whinge in a way which isn't in any way entertaining. But worry and feel angsty, but in a way which is funny, in the way that the very best Woody Allen stuff did. The movie would be a lot more problematic were it not for such a sort of terrific central performance from Catherine Keener, who absolutely commands the screen and who manages to be neurotic and worrying and angst-ridden and, you know, dealing with guilt, but in a way which isn't just totally self-indulgent. It's actually charming and funny and interesting and believable. And there is some... I mean, I think Nicole Holofcener's got a really good ear for dialogue. It's observational comedy. I mean, comedy in the loosest sense that it's funny, but a lot of it is funny peculiar rather than funny ha-ha. Oliver Platt is terrific as the husband who's slightly sleazy, but not massively sleazy, and yet fundamentally suffering from... He's experiencing what Woody Allen used to describe...
Woody Allen,
yes, there's a German one. When Werner Herzog worked with Woody Allen in the 3D in the films in the Caves. But he does that thing about, you know, he's experiencing what Woody Allen describes as the void. You know, I had the void, not the full void, just the partial void. I thought it was the full void, but it turned out to be, you know, to be gout. So it's all those things... And it's, despite when I describe it, I know it sounds like I could be describing a Noah Baumbach movie. It's completely the opposite of that. It's charming. It's likable. Very, very nice portrayal of the older characters. Every bit as crotchety as the younger characters. And it's a genuinely, you know, good, rewarding, satisfying movie. It's not a masterpiece, but she makes, Nicole Holofcener, she makes movies that you come out of thinking, oh, I've really watched a proper film. I've really watched something with believable characters and I've enjoyed it and I've been engaged with their lives. And I think she's a real talent.
On the subject of MacGruber, which we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, MacGruber, MacGyver.
This from Graham. Having watched the terrible MacGyver on French television, continuously rerun on a Freeview channel, it fails me to understand why anyone would want to bring it back in any form, let alone a film. And then he says McGee, by the way, which is
McGee!
That's how you're going to have to refer to MacGruber.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, fine. MacGruber!
McGee is played by Dean Anderson, the bloke out of Stargate.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Richard Dean Anderson, I think he means, but anyway, that's what we have. Graham, thank you for that. And on the subject of Ms. Heigl, Ed says, well, I teach German, and Simon is right. I'm only reading this out because it actually has that rarely heard phrase.
Simon is right.
Simon is right. Heigl is pronounced with the I. It is an Austrian name. Whether she pronounced it like that, I don't know. And then confusingly, Mark in Manchester, Germans would say Heigl, Austrians would say Hegel. She's from German stock, though, so I think it's Heigl.
Heigl.
Is that sorted?
Yeah.
And by the way, Ian,
I'm sticking with Hugel.
Mark, your bald head and makeup theory falls down. This is this came at a couple of weeks ago from a listener who'd gone to see
Prince of Persia.
Prince of Persia, and talking about the remarkable performance from Ben Kingsley. His young son, who I think, if I remember right, about 13, leant over to even younger son, aged about 8, said, never trust a bald man with mascara.
Yep.
That's the theory. Ian in Derby says, Mark, your bald head and makeup theory falls down. What, Yul Brynner in The King and I? Would
Bald man and mascara, and he's good.
So we will take exceptions to that rule.
Yeah.
If there are any others, even though we've only got 6 minutes left.
Okay.
In which case, make them count.
So I'll make it. I'll do this quickly. Our family wedding, which is. Oh dear. So,
how are you spelling that? For the people writing a transcript.
So here's the story. Lance Gross and America Ferrara are an African-American and Mexican lovebirds. Now, his dad is a Lothario radio DJ who owns a big flashy car.
Never met any in my life.
Her dad runs a car towing business. Her dad tows his dad's car, and then they turn up at a get-together where the two are going to announce that they're in love and they're going to get married, where the father who owns the car has turned up with a girl who is a friend of the daughter and the father.
You're making this deliberately difficult to follow.
Here's a clip.
You know what I think? I think it's amazing. I think that your dad towed his car and your dad thinks her dad said something racist and you're here with me. I just think this is meant to be. I think it's absolutely incredible. And it just connects all of us. I think this is fate.
Wow. You know, you just said that out loud. Okay, let's start this night over. We can sit and have a lovely dinner and enjoy getting to know each other. That's the point of this whole thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, the point of all this is to let you know that Al...
We're hungry. Let's eat.
Mm. Yeah.
I hear the gnocchi's really good here.
What are you doing?
I'm just looking at my menu.
We're getting married.
What? What?
Yeah, and then there's going to be a battle between, on the one hand, what the Mexicans want, and on the other hand, what the African-Americans want, and then they're going to have a big cultural thing together. And here's an indication of how poor this is. Things run so badly out of steam that about two-thirds of the way through, they introduce a live goat into the wedding that eats a handful of Viagra. With hilarious consequences. If you think the idea of a rampaging goat eating Viagra, attempting to get to know Forrest Whitaker better and knocking over the wedding arrangements is funny, then our family wedding is for you.
So do you think that the goat is an afterthought, that they looked at the film and thought... It isn't quite happening. What it needs is a bit of live goat action in there to go in and get stuck in.
I think what happened was they were writing the script and then on television they saw The Men Who Stare at Goats, and there's the one scene in that when the goat falls over and the guy went, you know what? The thing that this film hasn't got, a goat falling. No, I tell you what, let's not have a goat falling over. Let's have a goat eating a handful of Viagra. It's going to be hilarious.
That's scary. Do all those people automatically become camp at the end of the sentence?
Look, I went to see Sweet Charity last night, okay? Don't even start with me in camp, all right?
By the way, we'll be following the test match in the rugby. Australia playing England in Sydney. Half-time, exactly as Ian was saying, it's Australia 13, England 15. You can follow that on Five Live Sports Extra, usually referred to as our sister station, though I'm not quite sure why it's feminine.
Okay. Very quick word
can
about...
I just mention, l'anglais... qui est ascendu une colline, mais qui est descendu d'une montagne. That's the original title.
That's the original title, but what's the...
Englishman who went up a hill and came down Welsh.
Okay.
I haven't got that translated
yet. And what
yet.
In French is the French woman's left leg?
Eh? What?
The French woman's left leg, you know, with Muriel Strepsil.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what's the French translation of the French woman's left leg?
I don't know.
Oh, fine. I'm just asking the audience.
I thought there was a comedy answer coming up.
No, it was...
What do you call...
The French woman's left leg.
Answer. You haven't got one.
Yeah.
What was the point of asking that?
Because somebody might be able to translate that into French. La plume de la... I can't even do it. Can I do a Jarmy quickly? Because it's important.
La jambe gauche de la française.
Cross-cultural production team.
I've just given you the answer.
Do it again.
La jambe gauche de la française.
Avec le Muriel Strepsil.
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dom Jolly tweeted that if we're going to say un film de Michael Winterbottom, we have to refer to it as un film de Michel Derrière d'Hiver.
Yeah.
Very good.
Except that doesn't work.
It doesn't, fine. So, Ajami, cross-cultural production team, Jewish-Palestinian. It's all set in one neighbourhood, the Ajami neighbourhood, which is, you know, Tel Aviv, that area. And centrally, the idea is that you have all these neighbouring communities living next door to each other. And in the mode, which is now popular, you have a series of intertwining stories. So you have, on the one hand, you have a Palestinian boy who's trying to buy his way out of a really desperate family feud. You have an Israeli who has lost his brother, who appears to have been kidnapped, and he's desperately searching for him. He's in the police force. You have another couple who want to get married, but their marriage... It's our family wedding, but good, that strand. And all these strands come together.
Is there
in
a
way? No, there's no goat. That's obviously something that they've overlooked. Also because it's a serious and, I have to say, rather tragic movie. Here's the interesting thing. Structurally, it owes something to Crash, I suppose, although actually the real template for all this, other people have cited Shortcuts, but in fact it's Amores Perros, in that the stories all do come crashing together. It's very, very interesting. It has a real smack of authenticity, although it's a completely different situation, completely different era. It reminded me somewhat tonally of Gomorrah, which is, of course, based almost entirely on, you know, on true stories. There is a tension in it which wasn't entirely easy, which is, on the one hand, you have the naturalism of the performances. On the other hand, you have the contrivance of the plot, having to bring all these strands together. And as it goes on, they struggle to bring the strands together. You can see the pieces of the jigsaw, the mosaic, that didn't quite work for me, but it's very gripping, very well made, very solid, and a largely non-professional cast, and a very fine drama.
L'anglais qui est ascendu une colline, mais qui est descendu Galois.
Galois. No, that can't be...
That's it.
Galois,
that's
not
what
Welsh.
It is. The podcast is available.
He went up as an Englishman, he came down a cigarette. That's not right.
Our movie of the week.
Oh, Please Give. I thought you were going to say it.
No, I was. Not up to me, is it? I would not be so presumptuous. So here we are in our Saturday berth. We'll be back next Saturday at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.